Okay, so welcome to our relationship seminar.
Okay. So we just wanted to know a little bit about what you were hoping to get from this. Why did you come? And if you went to the, I think Rabbi Solis just gave a communication class. Who here went to that?
You're doing it,
the communication. So maybe you'll have some input on the communication piece. But did anyone want to share what they hope to get out of this class, this lecture, seminar, class?
I'll share. My husband will divorce me after, but I'll share. That's my sister-in-law, by the way.
Oh, brother and sister?
She said he passed the
cutting over. Oh, my God. You do it.
Really?
Yes, really.
Oh, my God.
Totally.
Thank you. Anyway, we're married, Baruch Hashem, 41 years. It was last December.
Beautiful.
And why are you looking at me like
I'm
that?
Just listening.
Yeah, it's true, isn't it? We're married 41 years.
We have a Democratic house. You know, some of you aren't familiar.
What are you talking about? And we still love each other very much. I'd like to, I guess, find out a little bit more about how to preserve the love and romance, which is there, of course, when you first meet and for a couple of years thereafter. Because, you know, there are many pressures that happen in the latter part of as you get older, that people, I think, underestimate. You know, such as the illness, children leaving, and you have the empty nest, retirement issues, those types of things.
Getting on a boat for a year.
Getting on a boat. My husband wants to get on a boat for a year. So, how to get over that desire of his?
You want to go on a boat for a year?
Not really.
Okay.
I have a gallery now.
Okay, good. Thank you. Who else would like to share?
How can you love and hate?
That's a heavy one.
No.
Can you?
No. Relationship. Anybody. Yeah. How can you make the love more than the hate?
Heavy. Well, I'm not particularly hoping for anything specific, but I'm here with my beloved Laura.
What's your anniversary?
So that's like up.
We're coming in on 23 years.
23 years.
What's your anniversary?
July 3rd. Yes.
Anybody here want to share?
I'll share.
Please.
Okay. So I just moved here from San Francisco. I grew up in Minnesota, lived in California half my life. And I got a...
We're both Californians.
You really were.
Long Beach, LA, but she was born in Oakland. In San Francisco, actually.
Berkeley. Whatever. North.
North of LA.
Northern California.
Yeah. So, let's see. I guess what to look for in someone else, how to know if it's there, how to judge them accurately, and how to make sure that you're the right person that you should be. That you're doing what you should for a relationship and not, you know, people don't realize that they're incompatible when they are. So how do you know how you really are so you can be the best person?
Okay.
And then how to sustain the relationship.
Okay, thank you.
So the sustaining is really a common thread that everyone wants to...
I would say... No, I mean, I think it's easy to get through all the times where you're perfectly compatible and the things that you like to do and your values. But for the parts where there are big differences or communication problems or whatever it is, I feel like what I want out of this is to see where we're making mistakes, like what we could do better, you know, as far as whatever the conflicts are or whatever the communication, the way, even how to, when you disagree, how to fight fairly, you know.
Fight? Oh.
Well, maybe fight is not a good word, but if you have a if you're having a disagreement.
She's teasing.
Oh, okay. Oh, you're teasing. Okay. You know. So.
Okay, good. Thank you.
I will get along very well because many times I'm right.
That's why you're getting for this class.
You know, when I was when we were getting married on our wedding video, I guess somebody said this, you know, they walk around and people get to say their little blessings or advice, and someone said that, you know, Elio should know that he's the head of the household, but Dina, you should know that you're the neck, and wherever the neck moves, the head's got to go too.
Is that a Russian saying?
Russian saying? Okay. So that was in response to your... you know, hopefully we'll touch upon many different things. I think that some of the very practical things about compatibility, we're specifically focused here on what does Judaism, because that's where we have... we might be semi-experts in, but there's many, you know, books out there, and I think that what we can do is set you on the right path or answer some questions or give you really what does Judaism, where's the richness in Judaism about marriage? And obviously, Judaism holds marriage to be this, like, it's the center of all Jewish life, really. It says that a shul should sell its Torah in order to build a mikvah. Now, a mikvah is the mainstay of a Jewish household because a woman immerses in the mikvah before there's intimacy. I'm jumping ahead here a little, but I'm just giving you an example of how important Judaism views marriage and intimacy and the relationship between husband and wife, that you can even sell your Torah to build a mikvah. So that's...
It's brought down in the Talmud.
Code of Jewish law. That takes preference. So what we're going to do here is, you know, hopefully you'll get set on a certain process or thought or thinking to a Jewish way of marriage. But, you know, I'm in the middle of reading a book here. Does anyone hear of this book? First Kill All the Marriage Counselors. No one heard of it?
No.
It's a great book for women to read. So I'm saying, like, sometimes there's just practical, she brings a lot of things that align with Torah, but, you know, sometimes... But being here means that you're invested and you care and you're interested, and I give you credit to somebody who's not in a relationship yet or wants to be in a relationship, just that you care enough to even research it. That's really great.
If I can just add that today we're going to focus on some of the core concepts from a Jewish perspective. We'll try to address some questions, but part of our plan is that in our next session... We're going to focus a lot of practicality, tips, and address some of the questions. But today we're going to kind of set the stage with giving you a Jewish perspective on what marriage and relationships are all about.
Yeah. So I just came up on my, you know, everybody sends each other memes and jokes. So this was from somebody's website, and it had a picture of a very old Orthodox Hasidic couple. And I guess they were interviewed, and it said, they asked them, what's the secret of the longevity of your marriage? And they said, we were raised in a time where you didn't throw things out, you fix them. And I think that says a lot about the society we live in today, is that, you know, as much as we supposedly care about our environment, people just today, I spent about 35 minutes dividing we had CDs in their cases that nobody was using anymore, because who uses CDs anymore? But we use them at preschool because we take those beautiful shiny CDs and we decorate them, we hang them, we get the sun shining through them. So I was separating the CDs we're gonna keep, right? And then I'm looking at these cases and I'm like, it's not just a case, it's a plastic ring in a case, there's a paper underneath, there's a paper on top, and there's another black rim around the case. So we could salvage the cases because I figured we could put art in the cases. But there was so much to throw away, is my point, is that we live in a society where we have disposable everything and we throw things away, and we are fortunate enough that we don't need to keep things and we can afford to buy new things, because how many times have you heard, like, you take this iPad that you spend I don't know how much money on, and then they tell you at Apple, oh, it's just buy a new one. Like, don't even bother fixing it. So that is the society we live in. So we're dealing with that kind of culture, and it's just harder to maintain the sanctity when you're in that kind of culture.
Okay, so I'm gonna focus for a little bit on the importance of marriage, kind of set the stage. Why isn't marriage disposable? Why is it such a big deal that, okay, you get bored of someone, just, you know, throw them out, get the next person. Now, granted, sometimes there's children involved, and that, you know, you have responsibility towards other people. But let's say there aren't any children involved, and you just get bored of someone, or they irritate you, or, you know, you just think, I'm not compatible anymore. We've grown apart, and so on. So why is marriage, or why is a relationship like that of value? So in Hebrew, the word for man is ish, the word for woman is isha. You can hear, just in the, even if you're not familiar with the Hebrew alphabet, ish and isha have the same letters, right? There's an aleph and a shin, the ish, isha. The aleph and the shin are the same in both male and female, man and woman. The difference between the man and the woman is the yud in ish and the hey in isha. The yud in man and the hey in woman. The yud and hey spell God's name. And the Talmud tells us that when there is harmony between a couple, then there is the divine presence rests there. When there is not harmony, then the divine presence removes himself. And when the divine presence removes himself, what's left? Just the aleph and the shin. And the aleph and the shin spell esh, which is fire. So when you have a healthy relationship, you have God's presence there. And when there's not a healthy relationship, you have fire. Now, parenthetically, the Talmud does say this, and I think Dina will touch upon this in a little bit. By the man, the yud separates between the aleph and the shin. In other words, the yud in the man's name separates between the fire. Whereas in the woman, even with the letter hey, there's still esh there, there's still fire there. So what does that mean? The Talmud says that the woman carries a lot more of the keys to whether there is a fire in the house or not. So the woman carries a lot more of the keys as to whether there will be fire in a relationship or harmony in a relationship. And we'll touch upon some of the ideas in a little bit. But we just see in this basic idea that there's something very holy and very profound about marriage in and of itself. What marriage gives us the opportunity to do is to bring the divine presence into this world. Now, on the most practical of level, we have varying ages of people here in the room. The greatest manifestation of God's presence on this earth is the ability to reproduce. Right? We can do all kinds of things. The one thing that we need to have God involved in the process is reproduction. And in the Torah context, in a healthy, moral, societal context, that takes place in the context of marriage, right? When you have a healthy relationship, there's a married couple, they produce a child. Now, even if people are not producing children, so does that mean that marriage is over? No, every time there's a union between male and female, there's a spiritual something that is born, whether it's on a more mystical level, an angel. But even just the union itself produces a harmony and a beauty in this world that is a manifestation of the union that God manifests in all of creation. Those of you that have studied the Kabbalah here and some of those teachings understand that at every level in the divine structure, there is a union. And the union throughout the divine structure produces the next dimension. So Chachma and Bina, wisdom and understanding produces knowledge. And so chesed and gvura, kindness and discipline, produce compassion and so on. So just as it is in the cosmos, in the spiritual cosmos, same thing is in the human union, that even if it's not physically going to produce a child, there's a spiritual something that is reproduced in that union. And that only happens when there is a holy union, when there is harmony, when the union is a compatible one and an ideal one. Of course, there can be reproduction in unhappy situations and unhealthy situations, but the ideal is when there's a happy union. So when there's a happy union, you have the divine presence, and the divine presence then gets manifest in that which is reproduced. The Torah tells us that when Adam and Eve were created, male and female, he created them. And I'm not going to get into the whole discussion of this, but just the core point of it is that man and woman were created as a single entity. And we know, according to the teachings of Jewish mysticism, that just as it was in creation, Adam and Eve were separated. We also have the idea that the souls of husband and wife were separated, and they come back together later on in life when they marry. That union comes back together. The souls are brought back together. So in a certain sense, if Adam and Eve in the Garden of Eden represented, male and female, he created them, represented this beautiful union, and it was only a secondary level when the separation began, when husband and wife come together, when male and female come together, we mimic that Garden of Eden state. We bring the world into some kind of utopian state. It's a rejoining of two souls. And we find something very interesting, that the Jewish ceremony surrounding marriage is under a chuppah. And under the chuppah, we don't have any, if you see on in all of the other kind of secular ceremonies or other religious ceremonies, there's, you know, I pledge to love you, to cherish you, right? All these things. You don't say that under the chuppah. In fact, the bride doesn't say anything, and the groom says 6 or 7 words. What does he say? Behold, you are mikudeshet, which means sanctified. You are sanctified to me with this ring. It's not about love, not that love isn't a critical component, but it's about sanctity. That's what he's committing to. That's what he's recognizing under the chuppah, is that this is it's a holy union that's taking place here. Love is an emotion, it's a powerful emotion. Ideally, it's a necessary emotion in a healthy relationship, but it's an emotion, and we have to recognize that. You shouldn't marry someone that you don't love. But love alone is not enough. Love is not sustainable as the great secret to marriage. It has to be sanctity.
Love ebbs and flows. Love comes and goes. It's not something that's, just like you're not always feeling happy. You might love your children, right? But you don't always feel happy with them. You don't even always feel love towards them. You could feel frustration and anger and all those things. So the same thing is in marriage. The ideal, this idealistic view that you're always going to have spark. I mean, you don't have that in your people. You might. I'm saying, like, you quickly realize that the starry-eyed, everything's perfect is not so. It can't exist all the time because we're emotional people, and we have ebbs and flows in our relationships, in our feelings.
So that's a very broad but general concept of how the Torah, how Judaism sees marriage. It's not just merely the coming together of convenience of two people who love each other. It's something holy is taking place here. And as Dina mentioned before, it's the holiest of relationships. Yes, children come into the picture and then they go out of the picture, and the marriage remains a holy union. And that's why marriage is so important. That's why marriage is so important to invest in. It says that when a marriage breaks apart, the divine throne, God Himself cries over that. There's place for it in Judaism. We the Torah talks about divorce. But that's not, that's last case scenario. And the reason why it's last case scenario, and the reason why marriage is not disposable and you can just throw it out, is because it's so holy. It's this beautiful, profound, holy union that We don't want to break that. But that also sets the stage why it's so complex and difficult.
So the challenge of relationships. First of all, you know, as coming together as men and women, men are from Mars, women are from Venus, call it whatever you want. It's interesting because probably we're back at a time, not sure when, all these people didn't think boys and girls were different. Then we sort of said boys and girls are, we're back at a time where everybody knows if you're marketing, you market different to men and to women. Let's put it that way. When it comes down to the buck, the bottom dollar, all the big corporations know that men and women shop differently, they spend their money differently, they look at their internet differently, men and women function differently. So the world knows, you know, we might not want to acknowledge socially and emotionally that women are different, that men and women are different, but when it comes down to the dollar, men and women are different. The biggest corporations are not marketing the same to all of us, right? So there's huge differences between men and women. I can't speak to the male side of it, because I'm not a man, but I can say what, you know, there's male and female energy each of us have within us, both the male and the female energy, and we know both sides of us, but sometimes we're so busy. Like, for example, if I have a very tough job and I work outside the home and I'm a woman, right? Well, then I might be exuding my male energy a whole day, because I might need to be conquering and accomplishing, and I have a bottom line, and I'm a whole day I am using that part of me, my male energy. And then when I come home, I might forget to shut that part of me off. And then that becomes complicated in a relationship, because I'm being very masculine in this relationship, and it's confusing for a husband, because a husband wants to be able to do what he's supposed to do for his wife, which is to make her happy, to please her, to cherish her, to love her. These are things that men naturally want to do for women. But if a woman is not opening herself up to that and receiving that, and instead she's being critical and she's being, you know, all-knowing, and she's being, you know, smarter than her husband, because we always think we're smarter than our husbands, and we might very well be, but we don't need to admit that, you know, to the public or to anyone. Like, these are the kinds of things that if a woman doesn't shift from being to her more feminine side, could make a relationship sticky. And I'm not going to speak for the, it's interesting, because when we were, this book actually that I'm reading speaks entirely to women. It's not a book for men. And she speaks about, you know, how the Talmud says that the woman holds the power of the Aish, and that she speaks about how a woman has so much power in the relationship, because what she says is we are the more desirable, quote unquote, of the two, because we're the more beautiful, and the, you know, because she puts it in those words that a husband just wants to be there for his wife, but we need to make that available, that he knows that he's able to be there. We are born physically as nurturers. I don't have to describe every part of us that nurtures, but we have a uterus, we're meant to carry, we're meant to nurture, even by not doing anything. That's just the way our bodies work. We're also meant to receive. We receive from our husbands, that's how we get a baby inside of us, but we're also there to receive their love and their commitment and all the good that they want to bestow upon us. And that's how we're naturally meant to be. And when we're putting up that resistance of not receiving for whatever our gimmicks are, for why we're in that unhealthy place, that again takes away from us being able to be the best we are and our husbands being able to be the best that they are. So
I'm going to put some of what Dina just said in the context of, again, the teachings of the Torah and the teachings of Jewish mysticism. A lot of what Dina said is on a very practical level, anatomical, experiential, but it has its origins in Torah and in the teachings of Torah. First of all, men are from Mars, women are from Venus. In Jewish teachings, men are from Chachma, women are from Bina. Let me explain a little bit for those unfamiliar with these terms. Let me explain briefly what Chachma and Bina is. Chachma literally translates as wisdom, bina is understanding. But in the genesis of a concept, chachma is, it's called the seminal idea. It's the spark of an idea, and you might be sitting in a class or in a lecture or riding in the car, and something comes into your head, I have this great idea. You put together some intellectual thought that you've been thinking about, and then it just kind of clicks, or an idea for a project that you might be working on, or something around the house. Doesn't make a difference what it is, but there's kind of like some burst of energy, or as it's called, a lightning bolt kind of hits you. Now, what happens at that point is you may take some time to nurture that idea, or you may choose not to. If you choose not to, the idea typically goes away. Because like a lightning bolt, if you don't capitalize on the light that's produced, it goes away.
Or if you get a phone call in the middle.
Right.
It disappears.
So you lose your train of thought, you lose the moment, it's gone. If you do nurture it, then you have something to work with. You start developing the idea and so on and so forth. You expand it, you deepen it. And if you do that, then you ultimately produce knowledge, which is the third layer. So the first two, the lightning bolt is called chachma, and the development is called bina, wisdom and understanding. And it says in Jewish mysticism, chachma is a masculine energy and bina is a feminine energy. And what that means is that men, by nature, are big lightning bolts. They like to make a lot of noise, like to turn on the lights. But there's not necessarily a lot of substance there. Not that it is not substantive, but it's not sustainable in and of itself. Bina, understanding, is a development of an idea. So bina may not initiate whatever it is, it develops it. The Talmud has a nice example of this. It says that the man goes out to the field and gathers the wheat stalks, but wheat stalks aren't bread. He brings home the wheat stalks and his wife grinds it into flour and produces bread that becomes nourishable and sustainable. Again, we live in a world that looks askance at these things, and it's in black and white terms, but if we strip away the emotional, social dimensions to it, if we look at it on a stark level, human nature is men are hunters, women are nurturers. The men go out, they harvest the grain, but you can't eat grain. You got to turn it into bread. Chachma is the harvesting. You just bring in the raw material, but it needs to be nurtured, it needs to be developed. And that's the very core of it. But before we go further, we have to acknowledge that this sets a stage, which is very complicated. You know, when a couple of guys go out to a bar together, they have a good time. They shoot the breeze, they crack some jokes, they knock a few beers down, right? When women go out to the coffee shop together, they have a good time, right? You enjoy, you have your schmooze, you do whatever you do. I don't know what you women do at the coffee shop. But solve the world's problems.
That's a good one.
The men think they solve the world's problems. The women actually solve the world's problems. So we have different experiences when we're with our own, so to speak. But as soon as you take the man out of the bar and the woman out of the coffee shop and put them together, suddenly the friction begins. Because you're dealing with different personalities. You're dealing with different characters, different natures. And spiritually, if we have different sources, how much more so as those spiritual sources trickle down into the physical manifestation, there's an incompatibility fundamentally. In any marriage, there's a fundamental incompatibility. So you might say we're all doomed. But this is the beauty of why marriage is so holy. Because when things are easy, you don't uncover the treasures that are hidden underneath. It's when there's friction, when there's tension, that you navigate through that, that you ultimately produce the greatest light. You uncover the greatest treasures.
So I want to, the male and the female, it gets manifest as incompatibility, I think, often because we don't have the tools and we don't have the knowledge. Most definitely, we are compatible. And most definitely, we need to work together. And we do work together. And you see many very beautiful marriages through people who work very hard on these marriages. But it doesn't just, without the right tools, it's not really possible because of the differences between men and women. But when you have the tools, just like Chachman Bina, you have that spark of energy, and then if the wheat is not brought in, the wife could be the best cook in the world, and she could have the best silo and the best machine to grind it, but she's not got nothing to grind. So each of us bring what we need to the relationship and to the table and to our lives, but it's having those tools with which it's first of all understanding that things that work for me don't work for you, and things that hurt me don't hurt you. And the way I'm spoken to, it might, you know, a man might feel degraded by certain words, which a woman could care less about, and vice versa. But it's that knowledge that we're dealing with different people, and we need tools to understand how the other is processing what we're saying, and how they're coming from Chachma or coming from Bina, or having a female personality or having a male personality, or being a hunter-gatherer, being a nurturer, you know, consensus builder, how things get manifest differently to our ears, you know, just because we come from a different place. And this is not about, like, you know, what kind of home you were raised in. It's not kind of what kind of psychological makeup you have. It's just simply about our physiology. It's who we are as people. And so having tools and, first of all, understanding this already makes you stop and say, okay, so I don't know and I don't understand, so now I need better tools.
I think that there is a very strong point in religion that in a family, in a marriage, there is a division of labor that is very, very clear, very structured, very defined, not as much as it is in a non-religious family. I think that's what you're referring to here. It sucks that, right?
In part.
Because, you know, the Torah also states that you should not really have too much to talk to your wife or to other women. So that's definitely is a big issue.
We'll put that in context soon.
No, I think that in today's day and age, the division of labor is not really... I mean, I have a friend who runs a massive preschool. Her husband's home all day with the kids. She's you know, he studies Torah, and he sends the kids off to school in the morning. She's off at work, and they're very ultra orthodox, and he studies all day. He puts them for naps, he takes them to playgroup, picks them up, and she's running a school. So I don't think it could be perceived in that. Is it harder for him because she brings home the dough? Is it hard for any man when his wife brings home the dough? I don't think that has to do with it has to do with any man feeling like he's accomplished. And we have moved towards more feminine times. In general, our society, we do. It says that when we get closer to Mashiach, we will live in more feminine times. We don't live in times that are full of...
Is it called feminine, actually?
What?
Is it called feminine?
Yes. We live in more feminine times in general. We live in times where nobody wants to make war. People want to negotiate. People want to talk about things. People want to gain consensus. We live, as a rule, in our general society, in more feminine times. So I don't think what we're specifically talking about here has to do with role in the house division, because we're both bathing kids. I actually never do shopping. He does all the grocery shopping. Like, I don't, this is not, it's
yeah, so
not.
Let me add a little bit. I think what we're kind of bringing together here is this. The Torah is consistent for all times. And what you're presenting is a question of practicality. What are the tools we need in a modern society to have healthy relationships? The first thing we're presenting here is there's a fundamental understanding that no matter what's going to go on in society, men and women are different. And recognizing our differences then sets the stage for us to say, okay, now that we know we're different, and we have different needs, and we have to bring different things to the table, And not being afraid to say that because society kind of looks askance at that, but saying, hey, this is what the Torah says, this is what the physiology, this is what our anatomies say. Okay, let's embrace that. Now, what are the tools we need? So I want to say two things before you address the article. Number one, because this is challenging, we have some beautiful traditions that are brought right into the relationship from the time of the chuppah. We stand underneath the chuppah, the bride circles the groom, and we place a ring. Right? What are these three things have in common? They all represent something that's greater than us. The chuppah is over us, right? The circle is the sign of the infinite, and the ring is a circle, has no beginning, no end. In other words, if you're going to come to the table, say, I'm so smart, I got this all figured out, it's not going to work. And from a male standpoint, I'll tell you exactly why it won't work in a minute, on a very physical, practical level. For a marriage to succeed, there has to be something that's greater than the parts. And when we recognize that in order for us to succeed, we need God, we need Hashem in the equation, then we're empowered to incorporate all of these other dimensions, all these other tools to be successful. The second thing is that we have a notion that marriage is something that, you know, it's just this fairy tale. You fall in love with someone. And we all know that you fall in love with someone and then real life sets in. And when real life sets in, both, not even talking about on a relationship, in the relationship level, the life level, there are bills to pay, there are children, there are diapers to change, there is homes to take care of, there's just the basic complexity of life. Forget, before you even get into the interpersonal relationship dimension of it, life is complicated. And it's more complicated today than it's ever been before. Right? I mean, it's just every aspect of life is so complex. So, and you're a team now responsible for all these complexities. That's challenging. And unless you're prepared to invest yourself in the relationship, and invest yourself in the relationship starts with educating yourself, understanding a book like this, the book like Men Are From Mars, and you know, everybody's got their idea. And nobody has the exact right answer. But by reading these books and listening to these classes and listening to these lectures, what you're doing is you're investing in your relationship. And you might glean something from that book and that lecture and that helps you in your relationship. But it's not going to happen by sitting back saying, oh, I got this figured out. It requires investment. And a little bit to your question is that as you get older, and there are different challenges in a relationship, and granted, the challenges change, you have to invest yourself in those challenges, understanding how to overcome those challenges. When children come along, parents need to learn how to deal with children. And they need to learn how to deal with children, and they need to learn how to deal together with children. You know, and when people are building a house or renovating a house, you have to learn how does a couple deal with renovating a house. And when there's job changes or, God forbid, there's illness, you have to learn how to do that. But you look out there and you see successful couples who are committed to each other and committed to working on a relationship that go through all kinds of negative situations in their lives and, thank God, plenty of very positive situations as well, and they navigate them. Because they're invested in it. By the way, it's not only negative situations that require investment. Positive situations also require investment. It's in a different way, but we all have to invest. When we're blessed with abundance of blessing, it also requires, it creates its own unique challenges. So, relationships require investment in understanding. It requires investment of time. As life is busy, you have to dedicate time to each other. And that, again, we live in a society where time is just, there's very little of it available. But it's not going to happen without investing time. It's a beautiful story. In 1978, the Lubavitcher Rebbe had a heart attack. And he had the heart attack on Shmini Atzeres. And over the coming weeks, as he stayed in the synagogue there. Shmini Atzeres, right before Simchas Torah, at the end of the high holiday season, when we dance with the Torah, so that's when the Rebbe had his heart attack. And the Rebbe remained in the synagogue. He had his office there, and they turned his office into a hospital. He refused to be treated anywhere else, and they made a hospital there in the Rebbe's synagogue. Anyway, the Rebbe was working. They wanted him to rest, but he kept on working. And they knew, the doctors already knew the Rebbe, and they knew his style, and they knew that they weren't going to tell him, you know, where to cut out his work, you know, slow down here, slow down there.
Answering calls, letters, speaking to people.
And he had a whole theory about it. He said, I'm not going to answer these letters. When I'm finished, I'm going to have 10 times as many letters, right? So it doesn't make sense for me not to do it. Anyway, so one of the doctors got wise, and he asked the Rebbe, he said, tell me what's out of the question for you? In other words, what must you do? Let's start with there. What's an absolute for you? So the Rebbe said, I forget the amount of time, he said, the time that I spend every day with my wife drinking tea, that's an absolute for me. That's more important to me than the time that I put on tefillin. And the ritual prayer in the morning, that time is more important to me. It's a very powerful statement coming from the Rebbe. The time, it's an investment of time. To spend time with your spouse. And I'm not saying that it has to be every day or every week and how much that time needs to be and so on. That the main thing is your...
Every day.
How much time? Every couple has to recognize for themselves how much time, what else is going on in their lives and so on. But the point is that it requires that investment. Not just your brain investment, not only your heart investment, but the time investment. So I think these two points, number one, that we have to give ourselves over to something greater than ourselves in order to ensure that the union works, and within ourselves to invest. There's nothing in life that we would expect a value to get without investing in it. Right? We all know that that's just not the way the world works. You want something good, you have to invest in it. If it's the most important thing, then you have to invest most importantly. So I want to talk about men, if the women are okay with that. You want to know about men. So where was Adam created from?
From Eve.
The earth. Eve was created from Adam. Let me say that in different words. Man was created from the dirt. Right? So what happens? If a man thinks about his origins, it's not very pleasant. It's not very uplifting. So what happened psychologically, spiritually for us is that since the beginning of time, men develop this fantasy of ego in order to prove their worth. It's a little bit funny, but it's really not laughable. It's a harsh reality about the male psyche. And it's for that reason that men are hunters, and that there's this whole drive that men need to be accomplished, and they need to show off for their friends, and so on and so forth. But something that comes with ego as well is defensiveness. And one of the downsides of ego is an unwillingness to grow. And these are all poison for a relationship. Now, what happens? You hear Dina talk about the role that women need to play and the attitude they need to have. And you may have read an article or two about how women need to, you know, women are the fire in the relationship. So you say, huh, me, it's my ego, big deal. She's got to do all the work. It's got nothing to do with you. And this is why, if we recognize that men and women have different origins and different natures, the only thing you can do in your relationship, talking to the men, is be a man in your relationship. And be a man in your relationship, a healthy man in your relationship, is one who doesn't need to push their ego, but is ready to manifest humility. And if there's anything that's difficult for a relationship from a man's vantage point, it is humility. It's a basic, for those again who've studied Hasidic philosophy or studied in Jewish mysticism, it's a fundamental, the subjugation of ego. That is the hardest thing for a man to do. And the place that it's most detrimental is in the place where there's the greatest potential for beauty and joy and sanctity, and that's in a relationship, in a marriage. So the challenge for a man is to subjugate their ego. And I don't have to paint the scenarios. The scenarios are endless where that ego can either manifest itself or represent humility. I want to just share one personal story that brings together a little bit of what Dina and I have been sharing. And I don't know if I didn't tell you that I was going to tell this story. I hope you forgive me. No, it's not one of those stories. So thank God we're blessed with 8 children. Yes, 8. And we're still married, happily.
We've gone through 2 home renovations.
That's a big one.
So we had 6 children, and then Dina got pregnant, and we found out that it wasn't just another 1 baby, but there were 2 babies coming. So even before we knew that Dina was pregnant with twins, Dina had said, look, 6 children, this next one comes along, I need a night nurse. I'm not doing this anymore.
I saw a friend at her bris, and she had her 2nd child, and the night nurse brought the baby down. I said, that's it. She has 2 kids, and she has a night nurse. I'm getting a night nurse for the first time.
So we get a night nurse. Twins are born, thank God. They come home, and we had it set up. We have a night nurse come, and we really had no clue what it means to have twins. So initially, we set the night nurse for a week. The night nurse came, and that worked for a week, and then Dina says, well, this, another week at least. Another week comes by, and Dina says to me, we're going to keep a nurse for a while. And I said, oh my God, this thing is expensive. And it was really expensive. It was a lot of money, much more than I could have imagined. And, you know, a week of night nursing, and it's not just night nursing, because you also have other help during the day, you know, and there's twins now, so everything is double. It's fun, or as we say in Yiddish, it's freilach, right? It's happy around the house. So here, 2 weeks go by, and now my ego's kicking in. How am I going to pay for this? But it's what my wife wants, and my responsibility is to do for her. And I'm struggling back and forth. And I'm just giving you an example of what I did here, is I said, you know what, God, this is your problem. I'm going to do my job. I'm going to subjugate my ego and my insecurity, and this is your problem, and you'll make it work. Long story short, we had a night nurse for 3 months. And...
but not the same night nurse.
Not the same night nurse. Yeah.
There's women that come in there, you know, night nurse that charge one night.
Suffice it to say, it still was thousands and thousands of dollars. And I had racked up quite some bills. And I didn't know how I was going to, you know, ever get caught up again. And for whatever reason, I had filed my taxes that year. And a friend of mine, I was talking with him, another rabbi, he says, why aren't you filing? You're filing in this format. You ought to be filing in this format. And I said, I don't know. That's how my accountant set it up. And that's how I've always done it. So I called the accountant. I said, maybe we can be doing it this other way. Basically, I was taking a 1099 instead of a W-2, and I don't know all the cheshbonos, how that works, but the bottom line is, I was doing it one way, on the recommendation of the accountant. I brought to the accountant this idea of doing it the other way, and the accountant said, yeah, you know, that makes sense. So let's refile this year's. So refiled the year's, and I got a refund of $7,000. That, by the way, that just was a third of what I needed to pay. So I said to the accountant, I said, you know, once we took care of it this year, how many years can we go back and refile? So he said, you can refile up to 3 years. So we refiled the year before and the year before that, so a total of 3 years. And I ended up getting a refund essentially of about $20,000, $21,000, which more or less covered the cost of the nurse.
Amazing.
So I was fortunate. Huh? Whatever it was.
Right?
Huh?
You worked overtime as an accountant.
Yeah.
You know if you call that, you can file back. But you
did. Yiddish a cup. Yiddish a cup. So, but I could never have anticipated on the front end that this would have been in this format. And I want to say that I got blessed that I saw a result of my efforts. It's not always like that. In other words, it's not always like that in dollars and cents in the bank account. It is always like that in the sanctity of the relationship. Always. But you don't always see it in the physical manifestation. So, again, I'm just saying that story as an example. When you do subjugate the ego, and I think as Dina presented it, based on this book, the idea that our job is to bring pleasure, it's something we fundamentally want to do, as long as we don't let the ego get in the way of it, we will do it, then that itself brings the dividends. A happy wife is a happy life. That is a result of the subjugation of ego. When you subjugate ego, that creates a happy wife. And therefore, your marriage itself is happy, and that creates a positive cycle that constantly builds on itself.
I just want to end with, bittul doesn't mean that you think less of yourself. It means that you think of yourself less. Think of yourself less. But all of us have egos, obviously. But I think the main point, as you say, bittul for men, for women, is to really, and this is when you're looking at for a woman, is to find a woman who really knows what she wants. And when women really know what we want, that's our thing. That we can, it's when we don't really know what we want that we make our spouse crazy, because we don't know what we want, and then we expect them to know what we want, and then that causes this whole spiral of effect. But when women really know what it is they want, and they can express it in a kind way, in a gentle way, in a respectful way, in a loving way, then that is the equal to a man's ego, is us being secure and knowing what's best for us, what will make us happy, what will make us feel. It could be the tiniest thing in the moment, like I just need 5 minutes, you know, I just need to have a coffee now. Even if it's the tiniest thing in that moment, instead of like, you know, one of the examples was, this woman says, I just want my husband to get a good job. And she's like, you want your husband to get a job? I need him to make more money. What do you want to do with the money? Well, I would just like to go shopping. The woman just wanted new clothing. She didn't need her husband to have a new job, and she didn't need him to make more money. She just wanted some new clothing. So if a woman wants new clothing, just say that you want some new clothing, you know? So women should really, like before we're reactive about things, to just think about what is it in this moment that I really, really want? What is going to make me happy? And as you heard, men want to make us happy. That is how we're both compatible, is when we're being made happy and when we know what makes us happy, and then men are able to do that for us, our husbands, our spouses.
I want to address your question for a moment. How do you know who's the right one?
Yeah, okay.
So, when our system of dating, contrary to how it's presented on TV and in the movies, it's not entirely not true. There are communities where people are set up, and in the sense of set up, where they say, you know, you're going to marry him, he's going to marry you, and they have kind of an introduction. But those are very, very rare. Those communities are not commonplace. What's more common when they say set up is that somebody knows a guy and somebody knows a girl and says, we think they'd make a good couple, right? It happens in the world as well. In our community, it happens more modestly. It's not like, hey, you know, Sally, I got a good guy for you to go out on a date with. You know, it happens more modestly, where the conversations take place between, you know, a suggestion is brought to parents. Parents discuss it with a matchmaker. The matchmaker brings it to the other parent. It keeps it arm's distance, so that if it doesn't work, there's no hard feelings. But ultimately, the couple date each other and decide whether they're compatible with each other, and they can date as long as they want. But it's very focused. Dating is for the purpose of marriage. It's not, again, there are definitely circles in the Orthodox world where it's not for marriage, it's for dating, you know, but in the Chabad community, dating by and large is focused on marriage. So in dating, in a relationship, there are two factors.
That it's also in the world at large, many people, you don't just meet a girl in a bar usually. People might set people up, but they don't necessarily look into their background. I think what's distinctive about what we do is that if somebody, if my friend has a, went out with a boy and she liked him, but she thought he would be better for me, before me or my parents would say yes to that, we would look into the background and family of that boy. So that's what's very distinctive, is we don't just say they might make a good couple, we look into where do they come from? Like, what is their family life like?
So there's two things. There's a physical attraction, and then there's value systems. Physical attraction, the reality is that you can be physically attracted to many people. And I would go a step further and say you can even love many people, because love is an emotion. You definitely can lust after many people, right? So that doesn't make, if that's not there, in other words, if there's a red flag in terms of the physical attraction, then that's a problem. But if it's there, that's an important part of the equation, maybe 50%, maybe even 51%. But at the end of the day, 10 years, 20 years, 30 years, that's not going to be the key ingredient that's going to sustain a relationship. It's a necessary ingredient, but we know that physical attraction increases when the other aspects of life are compatible, and most importantly, when people grow together. So even though a child comes into the equation and makes life complicated and difficult, but then when you work through that together as parents, when there are financial challenges and you work through that together as a couple, God forbid there's illness and you work through that together as a couple, you actually become more attractive to each other. The physical attraction increases. So the physical attraction is necessary, but what's to ensure that the physical attraction will increase over time? That's if the value systems are there. And the things that are important to you. And the things that are important to you cannot be superficial, because if they are, then those are not the things that ultimately sustain a relationship. It's the core things. What are the things, what are the core values that you hold dear in your life that will carry you through life? And when those two aspects are there, there's a physical attraction and there's an alignment on values, then you have the right person. I'm not saying that every value needs to align 100%, but they can't be at odds with each other. In other words, there's some things that you say, yeah, I can go either way on that. You know, I'm not so stuck on that particular value system. I can go either way, and if that's important to you, I can go along with it. But if I have a strong opposing value system, then when that value system is going to be challenged in real time sometime later in life, that's going to create a lot of friction.
You know, if you're going to be dating and kindness or generosity is very important to you, and somebody is consistently showing you they're not kind or they're not generous by the way they treat the help or the valet person or whatever it is, that's not going away. You know, if that person is always coming back and she's moody and she's always complaining. You know, you just hear it between the lines, and when someone tells you the story about their boss and how they're constantly grumping or gossiping or what, all those things, if that makes you crazy now, it's not going away. Like, that's the character you're marrying. You know, somebody who's complaining or gossiping or mistreating. Like, those are the kinds of things that you look out for, and it's really listening. What's dating for? It's like to listen to their, it's you're having a good time, but you're also listening. You're listening to how they repeat a story, how they told you how they treated their, you're going to hear about how they treat their parents. Oh God, Mom. You know, like, you're going to see that right there, right then and there, what their respect system is, you know, what their.
And people do change, but we don't marry with that expectation. You know, that's a fundamental rule. I'm sorry? Can they change for the positive?
Yeah.
Yes, I believe they can. But you don't marry with that expectation.
Yeah,
because you don't know where a person's going to... You know, you have a baseline. The baseline's got to be... You have to look at the baseline and say, I'm marrying the baseline, and I love that baseline. It's great.
And you're both going to change together.
Yeah.
That's going to be the interesting part of your life.
You want to read that article a little bit?
No, it's fine.
No? Okay.
What did you have to say? speak to women, you don't speak too much to women.
No, I can explain briefly. The Mishnah that he's referring to in Pirkei Avot, it says the Mishnah says, Al tar b'sicha im isha. Don't speak exceedingly with ha'isha, means the woman, right? So it sounds very derogatory. And the Mishnah continues, Be'ishto amru, with your own wife, is the context of the Mishnah. Kal v'chomer be'ishel chaver, how much more so with the wife of your friend, right? So at first glance, it seems like he said, don't you shouldn't be talking to women. The Rebbe has a beautiful take on this Mishnah. The word sicha in Hebrew is idle talk, superficial talk.
The lowest form of conversation.
Like base conversation, small talk. So the Mishnah says, Al tar b'sicha mi'isha. If you value women, you respect women, all the things, the spiritual, the physical, if you respect that, it's not a cheap, women aren't to have cheap conversations with. If your own wife, you shouldn't have cheap conversations. You should, for sure, if you're engaging with another woman that's not your wife, it surely shouldn't be for cheap conversations. If there's an opportunity to have a meaningful conversation with someone, when appropriate, that's fine. But if your own wife, she should be on the highest pedestal. She's not a person that you waste your time, waste your idle chatter with. Should be meaningful. You should want to learn. You should want to engage and so on. So if we think about it, the Mishnah is actually exactly the opposite of what it sounds like. It's not telling us to discard women. On the contrary, the Mishnah is saying women are so important and so holy that you have to respect that.
And it could be translated as, in today's society, men making, they're talking cheaply to women. Don't talk cheaply to women. You can interpret it exactly that way. If you're going to talk with a woman, it better be important. It better be respectful. It's not this the talk of today that so many women are finally fed up with.
It's Pirkei Avos. It's the first chapter of Pirkei Avot. I'm not sure exactly which mission it is. First of all, you're right. The Mishnah, it's less of a problem when women talk that way to men.
Why?
Because men aren't bothered by it the same way. Huh?
No, that makes sense. I am
not. But no, and therefore you value your relationships more than yeah. Perhaps other men do. But men aren't bothered by it because Again, I think it goes to a little bit to the nature, the spiritual nature of men and women, right? Men are the lightning and the ego, and therefore it's not on a nurturing level. Women take things in much more sensitively, not because they're sensitive, but because they're nurturers. They're taking it in. So when you talk to a woman, it's being taken in. When you're talking to a man, by nature, it's a hunter. That's why men can say nasty things to each other. I didn't use the context before, but in that same bar scenario, the men will say things to each other, use vulgarities. That's not commonplace in that same coffee shop where the women are sitting. There's just a different nature. So that's one thing. But yes, you're right. Society as a whole needs to...
Women are also not commanded to get married. Men are, by the way.
Say that again.
Women are not commanded to get married. Men are. It's not good for a man to be alone. Because naturally, women are going to look for a relationship. Men are not naturally going to look for that relationship. So there's a lot of things that are commanded. Women are not commanded to have children. Men are. Yes. That's another reason. Because women can't be commanded to do something that will put their life in danger. So the commandment in the Torah tells a man to have a child, but it doesn't tell a woman.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think really.
There's a lot of differences.
The concept of marriage is really a big trouble today in society. There's no question about it, even among the Orthodox people. So really, is the trend going to continue, or what are the really things?
We're changing the trend right here.
Yeah, well, honestly, this is obviously...
I think the only thing that can keep you know, my husband mentioned children in the beginning. I see people that they leave their relationships even though they have children because they think they're going to find love somewhere else and they don't feel treasured and they don't feel cherished, or, you know, they're bored and they're just, and I'm always like waiting to hear, like, did you find someone else? Like, there's someone in the wings waiting? No, there's nobody in the wings waiting. Women are willing to give up their relationships for, and it is the society we live in. And, but in order to, we first have to think that it's, the laws of divorce come before the laws of marriage, because you always need to know, A, you'll get divorced if you don't treat your marriage right, and B, if your marriage is not good, you can get divorced. So the laws of divorce come before the laws of marriage in the code of Jewish law. But it also has to be not an option, in a certain sense. You know what I mean? Like, it has to be that paradox, that it's an option, but it's not an option.
So where,
if it's such an option, it's an option. If it's not an option, it's not an option. Unless a man, I mean, according to her, unless a man is, you know, abusive or a drug addict, really, any man that you marry that you loved at 17, at 21, at 25, you can love again. For women.
And I'll say, look, yes, there are a lot of complexities and challenges in society, but we also have to look at the positive dimensions of society. You have this whole Me Too movement, which is. A changing, it's even if it's born out of a terrible reality that's gone on, but the outcome of it, God willing, is a very positive change in society, right? So when you have books like this that talk about real values, when people come together to talk about real values, that's the only way we're going to change society, is if people as an individual, each of us as individuals, commit to being committed to our marriages and working through them and being good role models for people around us. Because the more society changes, the more society changes. That's the way it works. We will do more of this next week.
Same time, right?
You're welcome to email questions or concerns. And we'll see you next week.